Okay, so let's learn. We're going to do Maamar Lamin Gimel. This is the 33rd Maamar Sishon Pashas B'Shalach. It's much easier for the legs there. So here's the deal. This is a very short Maamar. In fact, there's a number of Maamarim if you take a look inside on B'Shalach in general. It's a very big topic. And this particular Maamar is pretty short, but it's such a powerful idea. Basically, the way to look at it is one question, one thesis, which is usually where he goes, and a number of applications. He's going to give us four applications, and each of them are really quite something, really, really unique perspectives of things we may have heard before, and remarkable insights into how they operate. So the general topic is what's called Mesiras Nefesh. So we know what that means, that's when a person gives away their life, but it's with a twist. It's a little more complicated than meets the eye, and it reflects on perhaps a style of life, which of course he's speaking to people in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. You know, so we're talking about people who are very much living in this world.
It looks like it's a continuation of Pasha Vayeshev over here.
In certain ways, we'll see. There are a number of similar thoughts. So here we go. So it says the following: Kesha Amzu Yisrael al Hayam. So he's quoting now a Gomorrah in Saita, which is an Bereshis Bamivara, which says the following: We know this famously when Bnei Yisrael were by the Yamsuf, Hayu Hashvatim Menatzchim Zeim Ze. So the different tribes were fighting with one another. Ze Omer Ani Yored Tchilo Liyam, Ze Omer Ein Ani Yored Tchilo Liyam. Sorry, each one is saying, "I'm not going to be the first one in. Right after you, we'll be right behind you." At that point, Kovatz Nachshon ben Aminadav Yerod LeYom Tchila, and Nachshon ben Aminadav jumps in first. That's the way the Gemara says it. V'zocha mishum kach la'akriv es korbanoi rishon, and that's why he sacrifices his korban as the first. Interesting. V'komoy sh'om Chazal say, Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Moshe, mi shekidei shemi bari bayom hu yakriv tchila. He will be the one to get first. So if you notice, in the end of Parshas Naso, right, we lay in all the Shnei Masar Nesiyim. Who's the first Korban is Nachshon ben Aminadav. So the Gemara, or the Midrash in this particular case, is saying it's because of his actions where he went first, that's why he goes first. Okay, fantastic. Great. This is all familiar territory. We've all heard of this. In fact, if you actually look in the Gemara in Sota there a little more carefully, there's other versions of the story. The Gemara in Sota also says that the different tribes were fighting. And then the tribe of Yehuda went in first, and there was a machlokes between Binyamin and Yehuda. There's a lot of different versions of the story. We know this story more famously because Rashi quotes it on the Torah. He was, but there was one of the versions of the Gemara. It's the whole tribe of Yehuda actually jumped in. Very interesting. So different options as to what this is. Okay, good. So everything up to now is pretty straightforward. Here's his question. Here's the problem. Eich yitochein she'ashvatim larotzu lered liyam tchila v'arei am Yisrael emun or amun al mesiros nefesh. Surely all of Israel is already well versed in giving up their lives. Uve meshech kol hadoros mosru kihilos shleimos es nafshom al kiddush Hashem. We know that throughout the generations, large communities gave up their lives on kiddush Hashem. Ve'ech yitochein shedor hamidbar shenitztavu leyer liyam lo hayo lahem ha'oiz lekach. Why didn't they have that in there? Wellsprings. Why didn't they have that capacity to be able to just give up their lives? We see this throughout the history. It's one of the things that Jews do best, unfortunately. We've been given many opportunities to do it. So why was this such a thing where everybody was sort of shifting and looking at their shoes and nudging the next person to go in? Why was this such? To deepen this question, say like, well, you know, it's all very nice for him to ask. You know what I mean? You know, the Bnei Israel were the ones on the side of the sea. So he clarifies this with a very, very beautiful oimek, which I'm sure we've heard in different ways. This is all in parentheses, but it's an interesting addition. He says, "Umash emotzanu haflogo begoidel ma'aloso shel akedah." Ah, but wait a second. We see the Torah says, "Look how great the akedah is." Right? She ad soif kadoros oichlem Yisrael eschara. We all consume the reward of the akedah of Yitzhak sacrificing his own life. Varei b'chol adoros mosru Yisrael es nafshom es b'nehem al kiddush Hashem. We know that. Very simple people gave up their lives for Kiddush Hashem, right, throughout all the generations. So what was so great about Yitzhak? Right, why was that so praiseworthy that it lasted so long? Yes, giving up one's life is incredibly great. It would have been incredibly difficult. Only after they did that themselves, Avram agreed to go into the the fiery furnace. Nitzba koyach zeh shel mesiras nefesh b'Yisrael was it entrenched in the, we'll call the spiritual genome of the nation of Israel, u'me'ato kol ish Yisrael mukhon lazeh, which gave the capacity to all the people afterwards. If you want to just, I heard an interesting way of describing this, but this is weekend. As a friend of mine pointed out, a Me'ar Shilach, that's the Ishbitz of Rav Tzadok HaKohen. This is Rav Tzadok HaKohen's actually influence, predecessor, Rav Yaakov Liner. So Rav Liner says a very interesting thing. He says that when, you know, we have this notion that's called Ma'aseh Avos Simen Labanim. So, you know, on a most basic level, if a father does something, it's going to affect the children. So if a family moves to Detroit, their children are going to have to grow up in that school system. They're going to have to grow up with that weather, the climate. As they, obviously, decisions of parents affect children. But that's not Ma'aseh Avos Simen Labanim. It's more complex than that. It's not only the education, it's not only the environment that they create, but it's also that what it means is that out of the formation of the nation of Israel, everything was so critical. It was almost like the pregnancy. Israel was in utero spiritually. So it means to say any small actions had longer effects. You know, so you know, chas v'shalom, you know, if a mother when she has a fetus in utero is going to smoke. You know, so it comes with potential risks to the child. You know, some people have claims about classical music. You know, I personally apparently had Mozart and Beethoven. You know, in the good days, and I'm hoping it still rubs off. But the point is that, you know, we know that there's certain things that are very at that early point in formation are critical, right? So the what one eats, what one doesn't eat, is critical at that moment. So too in the spiritual gestation of the nation of Israel, every detail that could have happened had long-term effects.
We don't have that so far off. Like Shimshon, for example, Hashem commanded the mother not to already.
Yeah. So no, you're not going to. So even Shimshon with the fruit, right? So that's on a micro level. On the macro level, we're saying that everything Avraham Avinu and Yitzchak Avinu and Yaakov Avinu did had long-term effects. But what the Me'ar Shilach says is just an unbelievable thought. I never thought about this way before. He says, even so much as the thoughts that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov had actually created souls in this world, which means, his argument is just a fascinating thing. He says, when Avram Avinu was confronted with the question as to whether to go save Lot or not, and Avram Avinu had to internally debate, that internal debate gave space for the spiritual matter necessary for the neshamas to be created. Those souls that would be created later would be the ones who would not want to leave Mitzrayim because they had the inertia of not wanting to leave. Isn't that interesting? Meaning, I could take up with the thoughts. That's how Father Meir Shalom goes. Very interesting idea. What he is saying is, what Rav Chaim Shlomo is arguing is a very powerful idea, a very famous idea, and that is that up to the point that Avraham Avinu dug so deep into himself to be willing to sacrifice his child, it was absolutely abnormal. It was completely off the charts. Until Yitzhak was willing to go up there without complaint, without running away and sacrifice his soul, up to that point it was absolutely abnormal. But once they did it, they essentially acquired a certain, you know, gene pattern in the spiritual gene pattern of Klal Yisrael, where in the future generations, even simple people will be able to access that same sort of option because it was already the pathway, the neural pathway in Israel was created.
It's part of the DNA.
It's part of the DNA. Just an example, you know, Yafa Elyach, the Torah has a blessed memory, she has many stories. Chazetic tells the Holocaust, and she tells a story, a very interesting story. Let me say, okay, that's correct. I believe it was the Bluj of a Rebbe. It was coming on Kippur. They were in a work camp towards the end of the war, and under the Nazis. And so what happened was is that the Bluj of a Rebbe asked the Kippur, the fellow in charge, who was a Jewish person. His name was Schneer Weiss. So this fellow was even pre war years was not just apathetic to religion. He was an anti religious fellow. And certainly during the war, he was like that. But he made a request. He said, "Look, we're going to go out to war work. We're on your work detail. Please don't make us work on Yom Kippur. This day next week is going to be Yom Kippur. Please give us work which doesn't entail anything." And the man didn't even look at him and just walked off. And I sort of grunted and walked off. Came the day, and they were clearing up a particular cabin, you know, workman's hut. And so the Schneer Weiss turns to them and, you know, very gruffly says to them, he says, you shuffle things around on the floor and you wipe the windows with like a dry cloth, because he knew, he was a chacham, I mean, he knew the schitter, and he gave them melacha, which wasn't pretty amazing. In the middle of the whole thing, in rush two Nazi guards, and they have a tray full of steaming meat, right? And why? Because then Yom Kippur. So I said, "No." He says, "You dogs, fresh, eat." So everybody stays in their place, you know. And this, the Bruges Rebbe, was actually on the window. He was standing by the window. And so because this guy, Schneer Weiss, is the attendant, the superintendent, so they turned to him and they said, he says, Hunt, you dog, you eat this. He says, I'm sorry, this is Yom Kippur, it's a holy day. This is a person who never kept Yom Kippur, mind you. Right? So the Nazi pulled out a pistol and put it in his head. He says, eat or die. And he says, this is Yom Kippur. And he shot him in the head and died right there. So the Bruges Rebbe witnessed this. And he said, here's a man, right, who bechlal in his whole life, Judaism meant very little to him, right? A completely, a liberal, reformed Jew who wasn't involved. But push comes to shove, he gave up his life. Racham Shlomo is saying is where was that capacity? It was the fact that Yitzchak and Avraham Avinu actually acquired that he could reach into himself even at the most basic level and realize that his identity was a Jew when his back was against the wall. For a shocking, shocking moment. What he's essentially saying is, if it's true that there's this inborn ability within a Jew to do this, so then what's the big deal? Like, why take only one person, Nachshon and Amenadav, to jump in? So this is his thesis. A very interesting thesis in the next paragraph. Is Uvenira Bebiron Sheldvarim. Here's what I think, the explanation of it. Da'achem, Vadai imho yumetsuvinik leikones liyam kedelim soris nafshom lemisa. If they had been commanded to give up their lives and enter the sea, hayukotsu yam kishachot, everybody would have jumped into the sea to give up their lives. Bli hisus af larega. There wouldn't have been any hesitations. El Hashem yistavu liikones liyam amrasli natzel. That's not what they were commanded. They were told to go in to live. Right? Likpots letochot kedel lichios. Velokoy achzeh liikones liyam roesh vegoesh. You're jumping into, you know, a formidable sea, which is the, you know, a torrential, you know, a sea which will sweep you up to live. Will hargish ki iluhi hu charva, and to feel that it's dry, upoitiya hatzol hasam, and you're going to be saved in it. The madrega zulo hi giyo hashvatim. Ela nachshimenam benaminadav bilvad. He was the only one who believed that he could live by jumping in. Very interesting insight. Who kira Hashem Shemaim bekach, and he was sanctified Hashem's name in such shloichash behevdel shebein yam soer liyavashai. He treated the raging waters like dry land. V'lohaya kayam legabav elat tzivuyav yisparach. Fascinating. So just by the way, you know an interesting halachic application of this crazy case. If you read Sefer Makabim, which is the semi-historical account of what happened around the times of Hanukkah, the wars before, after, during, and after. It's interesting that one of the things that's said about it is fascinating insight. It says that when the Greeks were first searching the Jews out in the hills of Judea, it says that there were many, many Jews hiding in the caves, and when the Greeks first and the Hellenized armies first attacked them, they refused to fight back. And in fact, why? Because it was Shabbos. Fascinating. It was a Shabbos day, so they refused to fight back. And hey, Eli, how's it going? All right. So why did they fight back? So I believe it was Yehuda at the time said, Yehuda Maccabee said, it's Shabbos, we don't fight on Shabbos. And they lost 1,000 people. 1,000 Jews were killed because they wouldn't fight on Shabbos, and then they changed their policy. What happened? What was going on? I mean, like, to come back to your question, Yoni, you know, like, it wasn't that they were forcing, they weren't saying break Shabbos, they were saying, you need to fight. Right, so of course they should fight. So why didn't they? So a lot of the later Achron deal with what historically what was going on. I mean, the Maccabim were Kohanim. They knew what the rules were, right? So how did that happen? How did that go down? One of the answers which is given, brilliant answer is that, well, one answer is, by the way, it's Shas Exerah, because Shabbos was one of the things the Greeks were demanding they break, so they couldn't break it in fighting for it, which is an interesting answer. Another answer is that, and this is such a powerful idea, is if they were to fight the Greeks, it was a suicidal mission. They knew they were going to fight to die. They weren't fighting to win. That's how the unequal the sides were in this battle, which means when they fought, it was essentially a suicide mission. Fighting to save your life is Doicha Shabbos. Fighting on a suicide mission as Kiddush Hashem is not Doicha Shabbos. Isn't that interesting? They had no conception they would ever win this war. That crazy idea point. So if you think about that for a moment, so that's what's being said over here. He's saying the Jews, that if it had been a suicide mission, they would have jumped in. It's the other way around, right? But they didn't think it was Hashem was telling them, no, it's not suicidal. Jump in, you'll be all right. That was to have that level that it's so real to you. They couldn't do that, except for an Nachshon. That's too beyond the scope of even of dying al Kiddush Hashem. So he gives four applications, really very interesting. Some of them theoretical, some of them really practical. So here we go. Go 1, 2, 3, and 4. Let's take a look at these. The first one is this one I'm just going to summarize because it's more in the realm of what we've known. He quotes a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, which Hashem says, "Zochartil Chesed Nurach Avas Klul Lasayach Lechteich Acharabah Miba Beretz Lo Izrua." Hashem says, "I remember your kindness in youth when you loved, are sort of like you know, sort of metaphorically when we got married, like this, you know, in when we were in love, you know, and you walked after me into the desert to Beretz Lo Izrua, into this land which wasn't planted." So he says, "What's the shevach? What's the praise that Bnei Israel has?" He says that you walked in the desert as if it wasn't a desert, meaning you followed me in a way that you had such unshakable trust in me that it was like, you know, you're walking in the desert, you're walking in the park. It was just like, it was just completely consumed by it. There was no second thoughts. That's his first application with a few extra details. I want to get to the second application because this is absolutely remarkable. I actually came across this piece a number of weeks ago. Dr. Jaeger pointed this particular paragraph out to me. He mentioned to me, I found it in this moment. It's unbelievable. Here's his argument. Halachic argument. Top of the page on Kuvlam Test, he says, "Ugmar b'Shabbos, Amru she'en ha'soyser chayev elok she'soyser amenas livnois b'mukomei." In Mekoma, there's 39 melachas on Shabbos. One of those melachas is soyser, which means to say, to take something apart. So let's say you have, you know, there's a mechitza over here. So let's say you want to unscrew this mechitza and take the to pieces. You take this table to pieces. That's to be considered soyser. That's breaking down something, and you're chayev. But it has to be constructive destruction. Meaning, so it's not that you're going over to something and completely decimating it with a mallet. That would be actually called mekalkel. Now, mekalkel wouldn't be chayev in the same way. And if it was cathartic, then it actually is constructive, so you'd be chayev. It's interesting that the Gemara talks about that, but it's just one wanton destructiveness. It wouldn't be the same level of Isser as actually Soyser, which is a constructive move of destruction. Fascinating description. And the Gemara says that another requirement for it to be considered Soyser is Bimkoimo, so meaning to say, let's say I'm demolishing a house to rebuild a new house on the same foundation, right? I'm taking apart this table to reconstruct a chair, right? So I'm taking the same apparatus in order to take it to the next step. So that level, that destruction is called creative, right? Every Melachon Shabbos is a creative act, even the somewhat destructive ones. So, that's why it's Moichei Kamenas Lichtov, right? There's a lot of aspects of Shabbos where the opposite Melachos are one leading to the other. So the Gemara says a very basic question. V'yikshal kach, Rabba asked the question, Sharei kol ha-melachos le-meidim im-mishkan. All the Melachos were learned out of the practices that were done in the daily work of the Mishkan. Look, they did take apart the Mishkan, right? The Mishkan was made up of many beams and many curtains and many pegs and many, you know, strings. And they took that apart all the time. But they never ever built it in the same spot. The reason why they took the tent down was to put it somewhere else, right? Because that's why they're moving. Right. So never in the, we call it the original source of where the Malacha is, of what it means to be Soyser, was it ever Soyser Amenasli Vibnois Vimkoma? Was it destructive construction in the same place? It was in another place. Right. So that shouldn't be a condition. Very good question. The Gemara then says, V'tiretz Ula was one of the later Amoraim answers, Shekevon Shneimar al pi Hashem Yachanu v'al pi Hashem Yisol, that because it says that they camped and they traveled by the mouth of Hashem based on Hashem's command, K'soyser amenas livnois b'mkoma domi v'advarim tu'unim b'yor. He says that when, because Hashem told them to travel, it is like destruction and construction in the same place. What does that mean? He says, Hadvarim tu'unim b'yor. He says, V'loy marakan, ne'esh l'foresh. He says, such an insight. Shakavona hi ki makoimam shel Yisrael b'midbar hayo al pi Hashem. Where were they? They were always in the mouth of Hashem, so to speak. I mean, they were always with him. Eitzal HaKadosh Baruch Hu. V'lo nishtane b'mekom al yedei she'ovru b'makom l'makom. Ah, geographically, they happen to be in a new latitude and longitude, but they're still next to Hashem. Ela lo hoyle b'makom amu eitzal HaKadosh Baruch Hu kivyoch latinok haniste b'zroes imoy, shigam kishim aleches b'makom l'makom makom esh latinok lo olam echot hu b'zroes imoy. So let's say a mother's taking a child, and she goes from Cedarhurst to the city, so where's the child? So on the one hand, you could say the child is now in Cedarhurst, now the child is in Penn Station. Or you could say, no, the child's always on the mother's lap. That's it. And so he's saying, think about this for a second. Where were the Jews? The Jews were always in the Shekhinah. They were always being protected. So yes, they deconstructed it here and they constructed it there geographically, but we'll call it where they felt at home was in Hashem's lap. Such a brilliant insight. It's such a remarkable insight to what it means to trust Hashem.
I learned that in Rabbi Pliskin's Griffith Torah book.
He said this?
That was like one of the first things I learned from it.
It's brilliant. Always with Hashem.
It inspired me, right?
It's so true. Yeah. It's so true. We don't always see it. We don't feel it. Mm-hmm. He says now. Listen to the application. Okay. In the Omri B'Gemara in Eruvin, Yoshe Tzrifim Ein Moedadim Lohem Tzchum Shabbos Elam Pesach Botem. So let's say there's Yoshe Tzrifim. These are people who dwell in huts. These are hunters or gatherers who used to, sort of hang out in the marshes or the fields. Generally speaking, a person has a Tchum Shabbos, and the Tchum Shabbos, let's say you have a cluster of houses, right? So everybody has 2,000 amos around from their house, but let's say you have a group of houses, it's from the perimeter of that village, right? So we live in Cedarhurst, well, it's a little hard, complicated because we have like sort of joined villages all the way along. But imagine you're in a very small village, so it's on the edge of the house, you measure 2,000 amos in every direction, that's your Tchum Shabbos. But let's say you have a group of tents, right? So he says each one of them measures their Tchum Shabbos from the entrance of their tent. We don't view it as a township, right? Because of a conglomeration of tents. She'en chashuv meir hoyel va'edon keva ayin shom Rashi. Va'amru shom she digle midbar aval pishoyu yoshu etzrifim kevon dichsiv buhu al pi Hashem yachon val pi Hashem shau command kvia luhu dami. He says, but in the desert, nobody had mansions in those days. They just had tents, right? But nonetheless, we said that Tchum Shabbos still. So on the edge of the camp, but it was all non-permanent structure. He says no, because it was Alpi Hashem, meaning to say, when you're in Hashem's world, when you're on Hashem's lap, so to speak, then of course it's permanence. That's where you are, right? Upir Rashi Chashuva Chanayosom Niyos Nidedes Nidones Keva Va'af Inyan Ze Mispar Alpi Omur Ki Be'emes Digle Amidbar Kavuim Hayu Alpi Hashem V'Zeh Hashem Makomnitz Shenistavu Liyos Boy Alpi Hashem Nishtanu Mizman Zman. Geographically, where the actual location was changed, Davazeloi Bitzel Es Kavios Chanayosom didn't take away the permanence of their camping. Ki Chanayosom Loyos Ob Makom Zeh. So what he's saying is that yes, they were also in a desert. Yes, it was a place that you don't go with young children, and certainly not 3.2 million people, without any provisions. But they weren't really in a desert. From their perspective, it was like Nachshon jumping into the sea. The sea was equally as viable a place to enter as walking in his backyard. Why? Because he knew Hashem was with him. That Madrega Klal Yisrael wasn't quite at yet. It took a little while of the training camp of Midbar to understand that their permanence was actually in Hashem's hands. And that's his argument. I just thought it was a brilliant intersection of halacha and machshava. Now, just to close this with the following. So there's a midrash which talks about three individuals lived at the later end of history. Their names were Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. And the story goes as follows. If you look in Daniel Perek Dalet, so we mentioned them numerous times. Most people don't know the actual story because it's in Daniel, and Daniel is in Aramaic, so most people are not reading Daniel. But in Daniel Perek Dalet, it talks about the following. It talks about how in a particular valley in Babylon, the edict was the following: there was a large statue, and when they would make us, they would call. I think there would be music, or there would be a certain motion. Everybody in the valley would have to bow down to the Babylonian idol, right? And so Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah were people who didn't listen to it. And so what happened was is that they had this large furnace. And they threw them into it, and they survived. But not only did that, it was crazy. If you read the actual descriptions there, it's crazy. It's shocking. He said the furnace, the king was so angry that these Jews didn't listen to him. The Custan, the Chaldeans, the Chaldeans, ratted them out to Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar stood there, and he says, crank it up really hot. So the fire was so terrifyingly, it was raging so much that the people who threw them in died.
Wow.
I mean, like, we're talking about, like, I mean, can you imagine that? Like, it was a terrifying inferno. And as they're looking into this furnace, they see forms moving. And they're like, what's going on in there? And they walk out, right, alive. And it was so transformational. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar himself did tshuva at this point. Like, he was so moved by this. It's a remarkable story. So the Midrash Tanhuma says that Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, They went into that fire knowing that a miracle will be done for them. What does that mean? That's the Yalkut in Zechariah. V'lechor ha-taymah, to Gemara Pesachim, and we know famously the Gemara in Pesachim says related to our parashios, oy dezeh dorash tudus Yisrael, tudus Yisrael. I mean, so tudus who lived in Rome, had the following drasha. My ro Hananya Mishael Vazarya Shen Mosra Atzmon Al Kedush Hashem Nosu Kalvucham Mitzvardiyim. So there's a famous this Gemara is famous that they learned that they should jump into the fiery furnace from the frogs. Why, right? So what happened with the frogs? So the frogs could have gone anywhere. They could have gone to the fridge, the bed, the restroom, and the ovens. And there were certain ones that just went to the ovens. Like, what kind of crazy frogs is that, right? So they said, if they want to fulfill the will of Hashem by going in there, so we'll do the same, right? So that's what they learned, the kalvo chomer from there. And the frogs weren't even commanded specifically to go into the furnace. It says, v'heichon yesh kan mesiros nefesh, harei yodosh nitzlu v'yodosh likir shonam anashe yasalach mo'efes. But if they knew they were going to be saved, then there's no real mesiros nefesh. It's just like, you know, uh-huh. 1, 2, 3. So listen to what he says. V'apio amur nireh, sh'en kamanas chazal sh'lo yodosh likir shon elo adas shinatzlu. Hello, Niskavnu Chazal, the Shivchon Shehem Bitlu Beliyamam Eskol Ateva Veloi His Chashvu Boy Klal. We must renounce Shom the Sakana Veloi Higishu Klal Budavar El Shabotchu BaHashem VaHol Chamanas Dichyos. They so believed that Hashem would save them that to them it was like the Nachshon walking into that sea, where it seemed to him so obvious that he'd be walking through, that to them it wasn't even a question in their minds. It wasn't, oh, woe to me that I'm sacrificing myself for Hashem. No. Wow, I'm going to be the vehicle of a miracle right now. So this is v'hineh b'toisla sikshu. Toisla's in the Gemara over there. Amim Pesachim asks, lomo hoyo lemer kalvachoy mevarei mitzuvim hoyo al kiddush Hashem, kevan shehi ishi hoyo b'farhesya. Ah, the halacha is, if it's a public chilul Hashem, you have to hand yourself over. That's another one of those conditions for you. You have to sacrifice your life if it's public. It's not a private transgression. So the Torah says, so they didn't learn from frogs. Learn halacha, right? The halacha is it's public, and this was public. There was thousands of people in this bikkur. So the tirtzu shalohayo ze avodah zarah mamish elo andarta sh'osa melech lichoed atzma. Yeah, and Sean. So Torah says, no, it wasn't polytheism. This was simply a big statue of Nebuchadnezzar. It was just, you know, giving rightful honor to the Babylonian king. So then he says, wait a second. He says, okay. He says, v'kashela idach negesu. So if that's true, if it was only a statue of Nebuchadnezzar and it wasn't a statue of Avodah Zarah, he says, then how do you explain that? Shimkein eich huter lahim l'minso nashom l'dasa sforim ha'aso evrim shekolish shedino yavo v'lo ya'areg im nerag v'lo yov ha'arei ze mischayev b'nafshoi. He says, wait a second. The Shulchan Aruch says, let's say that you're not supposed to hand your life over, and you do hand your life over. I mean, you say, this was not a circumstance which caused you to put your life on the line, and you did put your life on the line. What the Shulchan Aruch says, you're mischayev b'nafshoi. You're responsible for your life. Ah, you've just given your life. But nonetheless, you're responsible for your life because you shouldn't have given your life in the circumstance. So how could they do that? If it was just a statue, and it wasn't really Avodah Zarah, then they had no right to give their life. Right? So he says, Apia Amor Hadvarim Uvarim. He says, no, this is exactly what the point is. Shachen Osulim So Nasho Boyfenze. Of course, they couldn't give their life not to bow down in front of a royal statue rather than a pagan statue. For Kohan Nereg Mischayev Benasho, you would be responsible for your life if you gave it in that case. Ach, Heim Nichnasu Lekirshon Aish Al Manasli Natsel. They knew walking in. This was absolutely, they knew they're going to be walking out of that fire. Where did they learn that out? They learned that precisely from the frogs. Why? He says, because the actual Balei Tosfos themselves on the Torah say that what? All the frogs died at the end of the plague, except for the ones that were in the ovens. Brilliant. So they specifically didn't, right? So what he's saying is, this is a very, very interesting idea. In the Shit of Toysus, that it wasn't necessarily a Avodah Zarah, it wasn't paganism, so therefore they really couldn't give their lives. But they weren't giving their lives because they knew for a fact that was so clear in their bitachon that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would not kill them, that it was walking into something which they knew they were going to walk out of.
Why did they know that?
So that's what apparently they learned from the frogs. They said that if somebody trusts Hashem so, so much. Now look, don't try this at home without close, godly supervision, right? But nonetheless, this is the degree that they were on.
They were protected
frogs.
Earlier, rather than Daniel didn't eat enough food for a while.
Like things were happening, right? There were things afoot. But it is unbelievable inside. I'll tell you why. It's funny because
it had nothing to do with
Avodah Zarah.
Yeah.
No,
it was they knew that they felt they had to give up their lives.
Right. This is they're making an example, and by the way, it was an effective example of how we don't listen to. And in this case, they knew that they were, now look, you know, when do you get that kind of insight? They were Nevi'im, so like you know, we don't always have Nevu'ah exactly. But it was funny because my son came in with a parasha sheet a few weeks ago, and in the parasha sheet it says, you know, did the frogs die who went in the ovens? And I always thought, yes, they died. And the answer on the parasha sheet was, no, they didn't die. I was like, I wanted to call the Rebbe after Shabbos just to make sure, you know. But I came across this, no, the Dasa came in. But I just said, no, they were the only frogs that didn't die. Right? So we need to say this. So this to me was a chiddush. But nonetheless, this is what he's saying. So what his argument over here is, and this is a very, very lofty argument. Let's come back to the thesis for a moment. The argument is that there are times that a person in life can believe in Hashem so much and know that Hashem is holding their hand to such a degree that the reality that they see is not the reality they feel necessarily. Right? That's how far it can go. Now look, we're all on the spectrum, right? We're not exactly the Nachshon space in our lives. But there's moments where we do feel that. You know, when you hear stories about 1967, the war, 1948, you hear about great tzaddikim and the Mesiras Nefesh during the war. You hear people who really, really knew, even though there was terrifying moments, but the people who had such a steadfast belief, it wasn't just to die, it was to even live in such a way.
Any given moment, you could always, if you really look hard enough, you could see God's hand in every little detail of everyone's life. You might not see it at this point while you're going through it, but if you look back, whether it's good or bad that you went through in life, you always go back and see, Hashem was with me at that time. I just didn't realize it at that time.
It's possible. So you're right, in retrospect, the trick is that in
that moment,
presence, to be able to fully know that no matter where you go, you're still in Hashem's embrace. That is the most incredible experience. To know that Hashem is with us, is holding our hands at the most crazy moments in our lives, He's there. He's there with us. But to know that to the degree that it makes concrete reality is a madrega which we aspire to. And that's something we do aspire to. We don't know the prophecy to know like they necessarily knew in the same way, like Nachshon was told, or like Hanani Mishael Ansari was told, but we do have other ways of knowing their critical moments. And so we should be zoicha. One last thought is that, you know, Rav Foreman always says a great idea, and that is, in life, you don't always get it's not like the movies, you don't get the dramatic music when the important moments are about to happen, right? You know, that would be the best part. It's like, you know, if you get the drama dramatizing, you just walk around this corner, you know. It doesn't work like that. So sometimes those moments could be those innocent moments where it's a domestic moment. You know, it's at home, it's with the kids, it's with the wife, it's with the friends, it's with the... And you don't really know that that's your crowning moment this day, this week, this month. But those are the moments where it really matters. So, Mitzvah Shem, we should be Zaychem. Anyway.